From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Israel today on the third day of his first foreign trip as president. And back in Washington, his administration is gearing up for its first budget proposal, the budget expected to slash Medicaid and other social programs. Joining us now is NPR congressional reporter Jeff Bennett. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with the president's trip abroad. It comes after a week of controversy at home. There was the unfolding drama over the firing of James Comey, the former FBI director, investigations into ties with Russia. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson waved off all of these domestic concerns, saying they don't matter in foreign relations. Here he is on Fox News Sunday.
My encounter with my counterparts, foreign ministers, but I would also say heads of state, these are not the issues that are on their mind. The issues that are on their minds are security issues, economic issues, issues of common interest to both of our countries. That's what they want to talk about when I'm with them. And these domestic issues just simply never come up in our discussions.
So, Jeff, so far on this foreign trip, has it given the president an opportunity to reset the narrative?
I'd say up to a point. I mean, the timing of the trip was perfect. The president left the country on Friday, leaving behind what was one of the most damaging weeks any president has had to face. And it's true that, you know, foreign trips usually provide a lift for a president's public image. And in this case, you know, the Saudis didn't disappoint. The pomp and grandeur they accorded President Trump was fairly stunning. And then he delivered that high-stakes speech on Islam where he broke with some of his more divisive campaign rhetoric. So the White House, I think, by and large, has reason to feel good about this trip so far. The president has stayed on message. But I'll tell you, there was an unscripted moment earlier today. The president is in Israel, as you mentioned. And ahead of a talk with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump told reporters he did not mention the word Israel in his meeting with Russian officials at the White House. He said the media got it wrong, and he was referring to the revelation last week that the president disclosed, inadvertently or otherwise, highly classified intelligence on ISIS provided by Russian he disclosed this to Russian officials in the Oval Office last week. But the initial reporting never mentioned Israel. So in denying something that had never originally been alleged, the president in a roundabout way confirmed additional reporting that the intelligence had, in fact, come from an undercover Israeli agent. So in a lot of ways, that gave the story new life.
Well, meanwhile, we're hearing today, learning from a source close to the fired National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, that he will decline Congress's subpoena and plead the Fifth. Tell us more about that, or how might this affect the investigations in Congress?
Well, it's not really surprising at all that Flynn would first be looking for some sort of immunity deal or that he would plead the Fifth. I think it's good lawyering, it's good counsel on the part of Flynn's attorney, considering that Robert Mueller, the new special counsel who is looking into all of this, could bring criminal charges. The Senate Intelligence Committee is the most serious, I'd say, the least overtly partisan of the four congressional committees looking into this. But I think overall, this really diminishes the congressional investigations a bit, and it makes Mueller's investigation all the more important. So I think it tells us that the big headlines, whenever they come in this investigation, may not come from Congress. They'll come from the special counsel investigation. So again, here, I think it's legally sound advice on the part of Flynn's attorney. But politically, it's yet another headache for the White House because it leads to more questions for the Trump administration about, you know, why isn't Flynn cooperating and what more does he know?
Meanwhile, what about this budget, Jeff? This is a proposal that's coming tomorrow from the Trump administration, but it is kind of a more detailed version of what we got from them in March, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And we know a few things. There's a lot more money in there for defense spending, nearly $3 billion in border security infrastructure. Funding for education will largely fall in line with what the president has promised on the campaign trail. So, you know, expect to see more money for school choice, things like that. The White House says the budget does not cut core Social Security benefits, and it also doesn't cut Medicare benefits. We'll see when we get the full budget tomorrow. But for Medicaid, that's the state federal program that provides health care to low-income Americans, his budget follows through on the bill passed by House Republicans to cut more than $800 billion from Medicaid over 10 years. And the Congressional Budget Office has crunched the numbers on that, and they say that adds up to about 10 million people over the next decade who would lose Medicaid if this is enacted.
Is there likely to be any resistance to this from Republicans in Congress? We know that there are some Republican senators, for example, who supported the Medicare expansion under President Obama.
Yeah, the Medicaid expansion. And here's the thing. Right. There's a line here in Capitol Hill. You know, the president proposes, Congress disposes when it comes to budgets. The budget is a vision document. If anything, it gives Republicans guideposts as they hash out the real budget this fall. But for some of the Republicans you mentioned, you know, this is not an academic exercise for them. Folks like Rob Portman of Ohio, Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, they're worried that people who they represent who got coverage under the program would suddenly lose their health insurance and wouldn't have any other options. And so this is playing out in the health care debate because the House health care bill that passed would freeze Medicaid expansion in 2020 and then ultimately phase it out. And so the Senate is really, really coming to grips with this. And whenever they send a bill back to the House or work out a compromise bill, I think this will be the major sticking point.
That's Jeff Bennett, NPR congressional reporter. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, to Illinois now, which may have to give up millions of dollars intended for new charter schools. 2 years ago, the state won a $42 million federal grant to open dozens of the schools. The schools haven't materialized. And now Illinois is cutting in half the number of charters it believes will open in the next several years. Linda Lutton from member station WBEZ in Chicago looks at what's behind the delays.
You would think that Claudia Quesada of the Illinois State Board of Education has one of the easiest jobs in the world. She's got a $42 million pot of money to give away to brand new charter schools. But that has been shockingly hard.
I've had over 100 meetings in a year to talk about the grant.
She's got one sales pitch she gives to charter schools.
Let's replicate you. You're doing a fabulous job.
And she's got a different message for school districts.
This is another idea. Let's be open to it.
She wants them to welcome charters, a tougher sell. Illinois imagined 48 charter schools opening up in 5 years, half in Chicago and half outside the city, where advocates have been trying unsuccessfully for years to spur more charter school growth. But so far, Quesada says, when it comes to funding brand new charters with this grant...
One
school, a math and science academy in suburban Chicago, was just awarded nearly $1 million to help it design curriculum and get ready to open. But with so few charters going after the startup money, the state has officially asked the federal government to revise the terms of its grant.
So that 48 will now come down to about 23 schools.
Illinois' experience may be a cautionary tale. It shows that even when startup money is there for the taking, there are other hurdles that are keeping charters from opening. Charters have to seek permission from local school boards to operate. And Paul Swanstrom, who used to head a high school district in the state, says, unfortunately, charter schools just feel like natural adversaries to districts.
Someone comes in from the outside and says, you're not doing a good job with these kids. We can do a better job. Here's what we intend to do. And by the way, you're going to need to give us 90 to 110% per capita for each of these kids to attend our school.
Charters rejected by local school districts can appeal to Illinois' State Charter School Commission, but that body has only approved 3 brand new charter schools in 4 years, only one of them outside Chicago. Even within the city, where charters have flourished, growth is stalling. Andrew Broy, director at the Illinois Network of Charter Schools, blames politics.
Tell me what's gone right for charter policy in this state the past 2 years. We've got a moratorium bill in Springfield. We've got a prohibition on charters buying vacant buildings in Chicago. We've got funding challenges like any other public school has.
To help avoid a teacher strike last fall, Chicago agreed to limit charter schools. Add to that declining enrollment in many districts, which makes it hard to argue any new school is needed. The idea behind the federal grant was to get successful charters to open more schools and move to different areas of the state. But not all charters are looking to expand, says Elizabeth Shaw. She's the CEO of Chicago International Charter Schools, which was once the largest charter network in the state, running 16 campuses. there's a lot to operating a school that has nothing to do with teaching or learning, Shaw says.
Things like funding and district relations and navigating the variety of operational and compliance requirements that it takes to run schools. And so when you think about going to a new geography, you are introducing a whole different set of players and a whole different set of challenges.
And that can distract from your main mission, she says, creating strong schools. Her charter network has actually been contracting, not growing. It closed two schools within the past 2 years, one in Chicago, another 90 minutes away. Illinois is waiting to hear from Washington whether it will lose as much as half of its $42 million grant. And it says it may need extra time to open the 23 new charter schools it's still counting on. For Here and Now, I'm Linda Lutton.
Jeffrey Gettleman's new memoir, Love Africa, is really about three love affairs. With Africa, the continent Jeffrey first fell in love with on a college community service trip, crashing on the couch of a slightly older photographer named Dan Eldon. It's also a love story about Jeffrey's wife, Courtney. They met at Cornell. He studied Swahili, plotted to get back to Africa. She wanted to be consulted. It took years for their lives to align. And it's also a Valentine to journalism. Jeffrey's now the Pulitzer Prize-winning East Africa correspondent for the New York Times, still mindful of the editor who told him early on, don't be the white guy writing the Ooga Booga, the caricature of the black native. Courtney became Jeffrey's videographer in Africa and now runs a law enforcement program at the embassy in Nairobi, where they live with their two kids. How they got there is a harrowing tale. That inspirational photographer, Dan Eldon, was killed by a mob in Mogadishu. Jeffrey and Courtney almost died in several war zones. Jeffrey Gettleman joins us now with the story. And Jeffrey, I want to start at the beginning. What was the pull of Africa?
When I was a freshman in college, I had this urge to get to Africa because I knew so little about it.
Yeah, so this is the real Lonely Planet time. This was pre, you know, the terrorism that we now know. You were doing things like sneaking your way on a Mount Kilimanjaro to climb it, living on nothing, idyllic. You go back a couple summers later as an aid worker in a summer internship for Save the Children in Ethiopia. And I just want to talk about the moment when the lightning strike of journalism hit you. Sitting and talking to somebody as part of your work, what happened?
I was really lost that summer. I was really discouraged by the work I was doing as an aid worker. I knew exactly where I wanted to work. I was in love with East Africa, and I knew I wanted to make that part of my life. But I didn't know what I would be doing out there. And it was in this slum in Addis Ababa, and I was doing this newsletter for Save the Children, and I was getting information from a man who was running a street children project. And as I was conducting this interview, I felt myself getting excited about the process of asking questions and being connected to somebody.
You write, a current shot between us, you and this man. Wait a second, maybe this is it.
You know, I kind of have a theory that we're all just walking this earth trying to feel connected to other people. And journalism allows you this excuse, this pass, you know, your press pass, to try to connect with people that you would never otherwise interact with. And that moment is when I got that.
And yet you start in places like Florida. At the St. Petersburg Times, you track down a pedophile, a chilling story, then move to the New York Times and the war zones in Pakistan and Afghanistan, dangerous meetings with warlords. In Baghdad, you have to wipe tears from your eyes in order to write about the carnage of suicide bombings, human debris you come to call manslaughter. You were attacked by mobs, taken hostage, serious work. But there's another storyline here. Courtney is still back in the States. Let's be clear. You were very honest about this. You kind of slept your way through war zones as you started working around the world and disappointing yourself, but almost destroying this relationship with a woman who would then walk by your side through war zones.
Yeah, yeah, it was something that I will always regret. I did some serious damage to our relationship, and I struggled with that for years. Part of this book is about moral growth. You know, I started out as kind of a knucklehead. It took me a long time to figure out how to sort of be a better person.
Although some of the women that you had relationships with in the war zones, you could also see that this was, you know, two people who are not just thrown together, but they are thrown together into a van when they're captured. And I think this is with Elizabeth in Iraq. Insurgents fighting over you, guns pointing in your faces. You could see how people might rush into each other's arms in war zones.
Your explanation of infidelity and sort of desperate hookups is very generous. But there's a truth to it, that you're in these situations where you feel assaulted and terrified and nervous and stressed out all the time. You're just totally overwhelmed with the destruction and the ruin and the sadness and the terror. And you're reaching out to somebody to get a break from that. And I did that.
You're also getting burnished along the way, we see. I mean, this is very Homeric. You know, we meet Jeffrey Gettleman on the beginning of his journey, this goofy guy, as you say, and we watch you go on your journey, this father of two at the end. Courtney eventually joins you as your videographer. Now the two of you are endangered. But can you describe, as you're, you know, getting attacked by mobs and scared out of your mind sitting down with a warlord, or, you know, just describe some of those experiences that led to that burnishing?
As a journalist, you want to try to cover the biggest, baddest story you can find. And often that makes you miss these warning signals and these tripwires as you're getting closer and closer to danger. For instance, my wife and I, one of the best stories we did was to cover a campaign by the Ethiopian military that was wiping out civilians in a part of Ethiopia where there's a minority ethnic group. We were meeting people with evidence of atrocities. We were walking through the desert with a rebel army. And the instant we came out of that zone and left the rebels, we were arrested, interrogated, threatened with death, and then put in an Ethiopian prison for a week. If you hear me say, oh, we were in a prison for a week, you think, oh, how bad can that be? It's just a week. But you don't know it's a week. Mm-hmm. And you spend every day thinking you're never going to get out and I'm never going to see my wife again. And I've totally screwed up. I felt that. And I was very lucky that I didn't lose my life in Iraq when I was kidnapped by insurgents in Fallujah.
Which is a completely different story. What happened there?
I was driving down a road to cover an attack on American forces. And all of a sudden, a van zoomed across the road and cut it off. And the next thing I know, there are dozens of men with masks on their faces and assault rifles, and they put guns to our head, and they say, are you American? And I had my passport on me, and I had just given it to the coworker I was with, a female photographer, who put it down the front of her pants, hiding it. And we then went through these intense interrogations with these guns in my head and these guys shouting at me, and the only way I got out of it was I told them that I was Greek. And they kind of looked at me like, you know, Greek? Nobody had ever met a Greek person in that part of Iraq. But I had developed this alias because I thought, you know, nobody's going to know how to speak Greek. And that saved my skin that day.
Yeah. Look, you mentioned the time you were – the horrible time that you were captured with your wife in 2007. At that time, your notebooks were taken by the Ethiopians, who then went after the rebels who had helped you. Many were killed. You end up asking the rebel commander, who becomes your friend back in Nairobi, do you think that journalists like you did more harm than good? Tell us his answer, but also, what's yours?
Well, that's kind of the operative question of the entire book. I would love it if other people avoided some of the same mistakes that I made. And one of them was this incident. And after we got arrested, the authorities took all of our equipment, our satellite phones, our computers, our notebooks, and they methodically went through all of our information and used that to hunt down some of the sources who had helped us. And that was a huge mistake. I should have typed up all my notes in the field, transmitted them by satellite phone, and then destroyed all that material out in the field. But I was dumb. I had no idea that the Ethiopian government, which is a close American ally and receives billions of dollars from American taxpayers, would treat us like an enemy. And I was in way over my head.
Yeah. But the United States in Africa, I mean, much has been said about well-intentioned stumbles that the U.S. has made. You write at one point, the values that America stands for are superb. It's what we do that makes a mockery of these values. What's that like when you are on the ground seeing the result of American policy and you know it's wrong at that moment?
It's horrible. I constantly felt like Africa was never getting the bandwidth that it deserved. If you look at the history of Somalia over the last 20 years, it's a chain of American mistakes. It was this bungled intervention in the 1990s where we went in to help people and then Black Hawk Down happened and we pulled out abruptly and left that country in chaos. And then in 2006, an Islamist group rose up to power, and they had a lot of grassroots support. And instead of trying to work with them, we backed this covert invasion that just resulted in more violence and death and destruction and a famine. And it would make me feel helpless because I'm writing, I'm shouting at the top of my voice from the front page of the New York Times about these issues, and they just keep happening. And I think Africa seems so exotic and foreign and almost irrelevant to American lives until all of a sudden it matters, like an embassy gets blown up or Ebola breaks out. But for those of us in the region, you see these things coming a mile away. We could see Somalia suffering and the bad weather that was going to lead to a drought, that was going to lead to a famine.
Look, we said this was a Homeric journey. When you were 30, you got a warning from another journalist. He said, I used to take all kinds of risks when I was 30, but now I'm 40 with two kids. I don't do that stuff anymore. You're in your 40s. You have two kids. Courtney, who was your partner through all of this, your videographer, how are you both changed? Would you ever be able to do this same thing?
I'm kind of hopeless because part of me knows that the worst thing I could do to my kids would be get myself killed. What are my responsibilities to the people that mean the most to me? And what are my responsibilities to this bigger group of people who I can write about and maybe help that way? And it's hard. So I will be going back. I don't think it'll ever be out of me.
Jeffrey Gettleman, East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. The book is terrific. It's Love, Africa. Jeffrey, thank you.
My pleasure.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
As of today, Ford has a new CEO. The automaker announced that Jim Hackett is taking over from Mark Fields. Ford's stock price has dropped around 40% since Fields became CEO 3 years ago. And last week, the company announced that it's laying off 10% of its salaried workforce. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and her podcast, Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So why this leadership change at Ford?
I think this is a stop the bleeding moment for the board of directors. Now, you mentioned that the stock is down almost 40% since Fields has been in place almost 3 years. But let's just look at the 1 year. Over the past year, we've seen Ford stock drop by over 17%. And you compare that with, say, GM, which is up 7%. So we can't just blame this on the industry slowing down in car sales. There are some very specific things going on at Ford. Sales down 25% this year. Profitability in the first quarter down 30% from a year ago. And maybe the most important issue, the board really was worried that Ford was lagging in innovation. And I think that is a critical issue.
Well, and actually, we talked to Mark Fields about that last year. We talked to him about whether Ford was doing enough in the world of autonomous vehicles. And he said, Ford is planning to develop a self-driving car by 2021. Here he is.
And as we go out, our estimation is by the time we get to 2030, one in every five vehicles could be an autonomous vehicle. And so we think it's going to change the dynamics quite greatly, particularly in urban areas. And that's why we want to be a leader in this area. And we've been working on autonomous vehicles for over 10 years.
So he's talking about it there, but clearly Ford decided that he wasn't doing enough in this area. How does Ford do compared to other automakers when it comes to self-driving cars?
Well, remember, we're not just comparing Ford to other automakers. There are other companies that are doing this, right? So we know, of course, General Motors has been testing self-driving cars, but so is Google. And I think a big problem here is that we talked a little bit earlier about that Ford is not as profitable as it once was. Well, that's been an issue because they don't have enough money to pour into innovation. And clearly, this is a big problem. And I think that until they start dealing with that innovation gap, they will be late to the game.
There was also the news last month that Tesla is now more valuable than Ford. Did that play into this?
Well, I mean, I couldn't have felt good, right? But, you know, Tesla's market cap is about $50 billion. Ford's is $44 billion. But let's remember what this is all about. This is about the future, right? Because last year, Tesla only sold 76,000 cars. Ford sold 6.7 million. But that does tell you that the marketplace, especially investors, put a huge premium on what you're doing to position yourself for the future. Listen, clearly, we know that Jim Hackett, who is the new CEO, this is going to be his complete focus, but you can't let your core business go astray either.
And is that core business going to be done more in Mexico? We know that Ford decided earlier this year to scrap plans for a new plant in Mexico after criticism from President Trump, but it turns out they've actually shifted some production to plants in Mexico.
Yeah, I think that Ford's really going to be focused on cuts. We know they're trying to save $3 billion a year. We've seen 1,400 people are going to be laid off. This plant being shuttered in Mexico is just that they weren't selling enough small cars that they plan to produce. So, you know, what we're going to have to see is whether we can take some of those savings, shift it into the development of the next generation of automobiles and trucks.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Federal court proceedings have begun in Puerto Rico after the way was cleared earlier this month for the U.S. territory to declare a kind of bankruptcy, something territories and states had previously not been allowed to do. Puerto Rico is pinned down by debt and pension obligations totaling $123 billion. Government workers are looking at large pension cuts. Dozens of schools in Puerto Rico have been closed, and there's been a student strike shutting down classes at the University of Puerto Rico for almost 2 months. Joining us by Skype, Maria Enchautegui, director of the economics department at the University of Puerto Rico and a senior research associate at the Urban Institute. Maria, how are people doing?
Well, you know, this crisis has been, it's already in its 10th year. So a couple of years ago, the governor declared to the world that we couldn't pay the debt. The bonds were declared junk. Last year, the Congress appointed a board for oversight. So I think Puerto Ricans have been taking this day by day.
Right.
And it's been felt in the streets. I mean, there is a lot of protest. Different groups are being affected. I mean, even the local bondholders. I mean, there is a reasonable size of bondholders in Puerto Rico that have put all their savings in government bonds. But I think what at this moment Puerto Ricans are looking forward is to honest politicians, transparency. I think there is a big claim for transparency.
Yeah.
And well, I think Puerto Ricans also want a roadmap of where are we heading right now.
Right, because you know how you got here. You know, previous governments overspent, just facing so many costs, didn't have the revenue. One of the reasons we understand people moving away, you know, moving to mainland U.S., and that takes a tax base out.
That takes a tax base out. I mean, it's like if you have a house for a big family, a lot of the southern half of the family goes away. So we have an economy and a business sector that is made for a bigger economy. Now a lot of these businesses are closing. A lot of the houses are not selling. So, yes, that is, I mean, it's a decline of about 8% in the population in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So it's been felt.
Yeah. We're seeing some little things happening that are not so little, but things like fines for parking and traffic violations have doubled. Whole government agencies are being cut. People are wondering if they're going to be able to continue to use cell phones or maybe just narrow down to one for a family. What else are you seeing?
As you mentioned, $1.3 billion cut is a big cut. The control board is recommending almost a $1 billion decline in the health plan for low-income people, $500 million in 5 years for the University of Puerto Rico. So, yes, those are big cuts.
Well, and you know, we're reading accounts of people who have companies that have had to fold because they contracted with the government and the government hasn't been able to pay them for services. And also, you know, pretty serious that services like the monitoring of child abuse complaints, they're just not getting attended. Yeah. People aren't there to answer the phones. How does this dovetail with the desire on the part of many Puerto Ricans to become a full-fledged state?
Next June, there is going to be a referendum which some of the political parties are boycotting, but it seems that possibly the pro-statehood people will mobilize. The statehood option possibly wouldn't sell economically. It would sell in terms of more federal transfer for Puerto Rico. For instance, Medicaid, Puerto Rico is not treated as a state. Mm-hmm. We really don't get a lot of the funding in Medicaid. So a lot of the statehood argument is made more like a statehood is for the poor.
Yeah. On the other hand, why do people who are against statehood, why do they think that would make it better for the island?
Well, they would say it is obvious that the system that we have is not working. Yeah. I mean, the political status of Puerto Rico is the daily bread of conversations all the time in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Well, and what about endgame? There are people we understand who feel that get through this bankruptcy, clean slate, start over. But if you've got a brain drain from the colleges, if you've got people who have the wherewithal moving and taking their monies and their tax revenue with them, boy, it seems like that might be hard to start over, have a clean slate.
It's going to be worse before it gets better. The reality is we have a liquidity problem right now. We cannot avoid austerity measures, but we have to keep the eye on the prize. And it's economic development. We have to bring economic development to Puerto Rico. We have to bring investors and investment to Puerto Rico, create jobs.
Well, but again, it's, you know, investors might be gun shy since they bought bonds in the past and now Puerto Rico's defaulting on them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a big, a lot of the financing of economic development from the part of the government has been financed on debt. So, I mean, for the next, I don't know, 5, 10 years, I don't know, looking at other countries, it could be longer. The markets are closed for us. So it's not clear how we can find a strong economic development strategies. Yeah. But that is where we have to concentrate, to move the economic development strategy along with the austerity measures or like a parallel track.
Maria Enchautegui, director of the economics department at the University of Puerto Rico. Also, she's with the Urban Institute. Maria, thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, between uncertainty about health care, President Trump's attempts to crack down on people in the country illegally, and his rhetoric about banning Muslims from the country, many people are worried about their future in the United States. Rebecca Plevin from member station KPCC found a health clinic in Los Angeles that seems to be a microcosm for many of those fears.
Receptionist Elizabeth Troncoso speaks mostly Spanish with the clientele of the UMA clinic in Los Angeles. But she's written the traditional Arabic greeting on a yellow post-it stuck to her computer so she can greet Muslim patients.
Assalamu alaikum. And then if they say it to me and they greet me with that, I say alaikum salam.
A group of Muslim American doctors opened the clinic 20 years ago. They wanted to help the community after the Rodney King riots. Dr. Miriam Vega is the clinic's CEO, and she says President Trump's executive orders and rhetoric are stressful for everyone who walks through the clinic's doors.
We're kind of like a snow globe or a microcosm of what's occurring at the national level.
The clinic has Muslim patients, but most are Latino and African American. Arabic scripture decorates the walls. Dr. Yusuf Tershani is UMA's chief medical officer. He translates one phrase on a poster.
In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. It's something that's placed in rooms to welcome people, to say that this is a place where you'll be treated well.
That feeling of inclusiveness means a lot to Lourdes Flores Valdez. She cleans houses for a living. She says qualifying for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, called Medi-Cal in California, helped her get her diabetes under control.
Yo vengo a mis citas constantemente.
When I didn't have Medi-Cal, it was worse. Now it's better, and I can spend more time with my family.
Then, as we talk about the health law, she suddenly starts talking about her husband, who's in the U.S. illegally.
If the president takes away my husband's job or he deports him, what will happen? How am I going to take care of my children?
About a third of the clinic's patients are in the country without permission. Dr. Tershani says some of them have stopped coming to the clinic.
They're worried that we may be a target and are concerned to even come get their health care because there may be a raid.
Tershani says some patients who are worried about losing their Medi-Cal are stockpiling medications, and there's a backlog of people waiting to see a therapist. Dr. Cesar Barba works at the clinic.
The worry is so deep for some patients that they feel it's almost like another medical problem because it contributes so much to their daily stress.
The anxiety extends to some of the UMA clinic's doctors. 4 out of 9 are Muslim.
Ab like your abs, Dell like the computer, ramen like ramen noodles.
Dr. Sahar Abdul-Rahman is the daughter of Sudanese immigrants. She wears a hijab. She says Trump's travel ban hit her hard.
As a person who was born and raised in this country, I mean, from Madison, Wisconsin, the heartland, you know, of America. And then to think that people are looking at me and, you know, looking at me like, because you're Muslim, we don't consider you American, or because you're from here, you're not considered an American, is really, it's a hard thing to take because this is the only country I've known. This is my home. And to not feel like you're welcome here, it's hard.
Tershani, the chief medical officer, says his religion provides a guide for helping his doctors juggle their patient stress and their own.
There's actually a teaching in Islam, which is when God wants to reward someone, he puts them through a challenge. There's analogous sayings such as, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
The UMA clinic had already been planning to expand its mental health services before the election. But now, Tershani says, the need is even greater than before. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
The messaging app Slack describes itself as team communication for the 21st century and says it brings all the pieces and people you need together so you can actually get things done. The company was valued at $3.8 billion last year and says it has 5 million daily active users. Molly Fisher, who's senior editor for The Cut at New York Magazine, writes that Slack can also bring a new kind of stress to the workplace. She wrote about Slack in the most recent issue of New York Magazine and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you write that Slack, which was first released in 2013, has essentially ushered employer-sanctioned social media into the workplace. Now, for people who have never used Slack, can you first just describe what it is and how it's used?
Well, Slack is essentially a chat tool. It's if you're familiar with AIM or GChat, you know, you can sort of send direct messages to people you want to talk to. You can also have channels. So your workplace might have like channels set up for different departments or different projects or different teams. And you open Slack. Slack greets you with a friendly message. It says something like, the day just got better. You're here. Your friends at Slack as it loads. And then you get a nice little bar with all the people you might want to talk to at your workplace and all the conversations that are happening around you. And you can kind of hop around between them and talk through whatever you might have otherwise discussed over an email or in a meeting.
And you can talk to everyone on the staff, or you can talk to individual people. You can have private conversations.
Yes, exactly.
And is one of the main reasons for Slack just to cut down on the number of email messages going back and forth?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, everyone complains about email all the time. And so the idea of having something that would be an email killer, something that would like make email less burdensome for all of us, is enormously appealing, I think, to a lot of employers and to a lot of employees. The tricky thing, of course, is that any tool, once you come to rely on it and once it becomes a huge presence in your workday, can start to feel onerous in the way that email feels like a burden sometimes now. So the open question is kind of whether Slack will in time become just as burdensome as email feels to some people.
You know, one of the things that you write about is that because coworkers can communicate with each other privately on Slack, that employees at Gawker used Slack to talk about whether to unionize. And they did unionize.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it was a big part of how they came to that decision and how that kind of unfolded for that group of coworkers. And one of a former Gawker employee described to me how, on one hand, you had these sort of big, like almost voter guide type chats that were happening in channels that pretty much everyone could view, where people walked through the pros and cons. And then you had sort of heated debates that happened in private channels and in DMs, where people were revealing their opinions and how they really were thinking about this stuff and how they felt. And this employee was describing being really surprised by some of the things people were willing to say and the sort of opinions that people were willing to air, and feeling like, you know, there was a willingness to be more direct and aggressive and intense than perhaps they would have been in a face-to-face conversation.
Are those conversations secret from the management? Or if you get Slack at your company, does the manager have the ability to look at all the conversations?
Well, it depends. They don't have the ability to like read your Slacks in real time or anything like that. But depending on the subscription plan that they are paying for, they may be able to request an export of all the slacks that have been exchanged at your company. So they can kind of request that full record, which is a tool for industries like finance that need legally to have full records of their communications. So Slack will provide that option if you're paying for it, but it's not typically part of the package.
So how did you find that people feel about Slack at this point? I mean, it seems like there's already, even though it's relatively new, there's already a little bit of concern that it's annoying, that it's another layer of communication that maybe we don't need. But at the same time, people are adopting it.
I think people have at this point already kind of a love-hate relationship with Slack. I think I hate to say this because it sounds corny. It can be really fun. Like it feels good to be engaged with your colleagues moment to moment, you know, talking through the things that you're interested in or complaining about the things that are annoying you. But it does also feel like it's a constant barrage of notifications. But, you know, I think if you work in an office that relies on Slack, it's easy to feel like you're not really participating in your workplace if you're not sort of present on Slack. If you seem like you're absent, you feel sometimes like you're a slacker in the not branded sense of the term.
Well, that brings up the question of why they named it Slack, that I'm slacking at work. That doesn't sound good.
They arrived at the name, they liked the name, and then after having established the name Slack and finding that they needed to explain why they had a workplace chat tool that was called Slack, they came up with the acronym Searchable Log of All Communications and Knowledge, which Slack, of course, is an acronym for.
Oh, it's always funny to come up with the name first and then figure out the acronym later.
In this case, it worked out well.
That's Molly Fisher, a senior editor for The Cut at New York Magazine. Her article, What Happens When Work Becomes a Nonstop Chat Room, is in the new issue, and we'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Molly, thanks.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.